Employment options for people with significant disabilities. SourceAmerica.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Those concerned about the environment and about sustainability have longed for the day when solar power would become more practical, a day when individual homes, even entire neighborhoods, could reliably and affordably depend on the sun to generate electric power. Well, we may be getting closer to that day, and thanks to improvements in technology, declining technology costs, as well as tax credits and favorable state standards, the solar industry in North Carolina has swiftly grown from a position of near non-existence to being the fourth largest of its kind in the nation. But there are those who see this progress being threatened, and so we're going to talk about that and about the reality of solar power as a whole this hour. Steve Calland is Executive Director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State University. He joins us this morning by phone. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. John Morrison is Senior Vice President of Asset Management and Government Affairs at Strata Solar. That's a solar development and construction company located in Chapel Hill, where John Morrison joins us this morning from the studios of WUNC. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And in our studio here in Charlotte is Randy Wheelis, the renewable spokesperson for Duke Energy. Thank you for joining us, too.
Good to be here.
Obviously, if North Carolina's solar industry has grown to the fourth largest in the nation, it must mean that this state is a good place for solar, aside from some of the things that I just mentioned about why it might be popular here, like tax incentives and favorable state standards. What makes it so? Why have we grown so quickly, Steve?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. I know a lot of people think about North Carolina and think about the weather, at least that we've been having up here in the Triangle with all the rain, and wonder if this is a good place to do solar. But it turns out that climate-wise, we're doing great here in North Carolina. You know, the variation in solar resource that's available between, say, Arizona and Maine is only about 10%. North Carolina is, well within the area geographically to do a lot of solar, and that combined with, what has taken us about, 15 years or so of working on different policy initiatives to make the market the right shape has really opened the door to growth in this area.
And I take it that we have become fourth in the nation in terms of the size of our solar power industry, not through individual homeowners putting solar arrays in their backyard or on their roofs, but through companies like John Morrison, Strata Solar, that are installing these devices, these solar collection arrays, wholesale on enormous plots of land. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Go ahead, John.
Utility scale solar, the large ground mount, is by far the predominant source of solar energy in North Carolina.
And what has helped your industry? Has it been the tax incentives? Has it been the abundant sunshine? What has helped you grow so quickly?
Well, certainly those are contributing factors. I think the most significant factor is that the cost of solar has dropped dramatically over the past 5 years. If you look just across the nation, information from the Energy Information Administration, it used to cost about $4.80 a watt to install solar at that large utility scale. Today, across the nation, it's being done at $1.80 a watt. And that sort of decline in price in about 4 years has just opened up the market tremendously.
I'm going to ask you an unfair question, Randy. Do you have any idea what it costs per watt to build a power plant?
a little less than solar. Solar is still a little more expensive than traditional generation. But, North Carolina's got a strong story to tell on solar. I mean, we are fourth in the nation. And energy policy has a lot to do with that. But Duke Energy is a big purchaser of solar power, a lot of it from Strata Solar and other developers in North Carolina. And that's going to continue. I think we've got a lot of momentum. I think we're going to keep it up.
Steve, what has caused to make these photoelectric cells cheaper, these arrays cheaper? Why have they dropped in price?
Well, the biggest reason is scale. It's the old Henry Ford lesson. The more you build them, the cheaper they get. The work that's been done at the federal level in this country and at the state level in North Carolina, as well as a lot of countries around the world that see this as an important issue and, need to diversify our electricity generation resources as important, they've all worked aggressively to help increase the market for these technologies. And by doing that, we've now got a scale of production in solar that has really helped to drive down the per panel cost. That, combined with a lot of work on what we call the soft costs, everything from, you know, permitting to training, you know, even some of the balance of systems issues, you know, the things that take the solar energy and convert it from DC to AC so that you can get it out of your wall socket. All of those things have come down in price as we've gotten more experience with it, as the utilities have gotten more experience with it. And so all of those things are kind of combining to push the technology cheaper and cheaper.
And has the efficiency of these individual arrays or these or the sum of these arrays increased exponentially? Or how would you describe how the efficiency has changed over the years?
Well, I think the efficiency has changed quite a bit since the days of, you know, using solar exclusively on satellites in the 1950s and 60s. You know, the solar energy that came out of my watch, you know, when I was a kid in the 1970s, I had a nice little Armatron solar watch. You know, that electricity was not very efficient, and it was pretty expensive in the relative scheme of things. Today, panels have gotten much, much more efficient than they were then. But really, the thing that's driving a lot of the efficiency gains is not it's not the efficiency of the panel, it's the efficiency in financing. The industry has gotten very savvy in working with the banking community to come up with new and innovative ways to finance the technology, and that has really helped to drive down costs as well.
This is also an industry that we are told got its start in the United States. All the research and development on this was done here, but it has been commandeered, as many things have, by the Chinese, and we have fallen behind in that. Is that still the case, or are things beginning to reverse?
Well, I would
go ahead, John.
I think what's happened is in solar the same thing that's happened in most of the other semiconductor industries that we see. Solar photovoltaic cells are essentially made from semiconductor material, and like our smartphones, like our big screen TVs, and the like, the location of manufacturing has moved to low cost areas of the globe. This is a global industry. At this point, I think in terms of research and development and new technologies, the U.S. still leads in that regard. But as with many other technologies, once that intellectual property is widely available, it moves to low-cost parts of the globe.
And now we're using the sun to generate electric power, but we're also using it to heat water. And I forget, there's a name for that, thermal technologies. And,
That's correct. And
some consumers are actually doing that too. They have these big tanks of water buried in their backyards, essentially, and it's heated in these arrays, and they use it for hot water and other purposes to heat homes. When we talk about solar power, are we talking about that too, or are we simply talking about electric generation?
Well, most of what people talk about is the electrical generation. Solar thermal certainly is a very viable technology. It does not lend itself to large scale in the same manner that electricity does. It generally is specific to an individual user. As you pointed out, that's primarily residential. There is some commercial use as well. But when you get to electricity generation, it is possible to build very, very large facilities. The ones we build here in North Carolina are relatively modest in size. They're typically 5 megawatts in output. That's approximately 40 acres of array. But if you go out to the desert southwest, you'll see arrays that are 100, 200, even 500 megawatts in size. So 100 times what we're doing in North Carolina.
Now, the sun can only produce electricity when it's shining, and the sun, as we know, does not shine every day, and it certainly does not shine at night. So the challenge here, it would seem to me, is that you have to have really good storage capability in the form of batteries, and obviously you have to remain on the grid because even that's not going to probably power the house for all that long. How much of the advance in solar technology has come from the advance in our ability to store this power in batteries?
Go ahead, Randy.
You know, we're doing a lot of research on battery technology. I think the largest commercial battery in the nation is at a Duke facility in Texas. So, but still, you know, solar is going to still be a good complement to a diverse energy mix. I mean, you're still going to need coal, nuclear, natural gas. But storage is still probably not ready for prime time, but we're doing a lot of research with it. And finding out where it makes the most sense to place those batteries.
At Duke Energy, do you see this as a logical part and a valuable part of the mix, because you do have water power, you have coal power, you have nuclear power generated, electric power. Is this part of it?
Yeah, I think solar is part of it, energy storage. I mean, we've been generating electricity for 100 years, mm-hmm. hydro, coal, nuclear, and really solar is just the next step in that evolution, and we think we can do that as well.
Do you have your own arrays?
Yeah, actually, you know, if you look, we have some small amount in North Carolina. We actually buy a lot of it in North Carolina from larger developers like Strata. Mm-hmm. It's just a little more cost effective. But if you look at our commercial businesses that operate outside of the Carolinas, we've got solar and wind in 12 states. We've invested $3.5 billion over the past 7 years. So we're a very active player in both renewables, wind and solar.
Why is it more cost effective for Duke Energy to buy power from people like from companies like Strata?
There's actually, I think they can take advantage of the tax credits a little better than a utility can that has to spread out those advantages over the life of the asset. So, but, you know, there may be times where, you know, Duke will be building solar assets in the future. So right now it's purchasing, but I think you'll see Duke much more active in the future as well.
When you hear words like that, John Morrison is the vice president for Strata Solar. Does that scare you that Duke might get into the business wholesale by or full scale by building your own arrays?
Oh, absolutely not. I think it's inevitable that utilities will own and operate solar. We're actually working with Duke to that very end. I think the issue is who's going to build it? You know, one of the things that Strata can do is build solar, large-scale solar, very efficiently. So mm-hmm. we'd be more than happy to build those systems for Duke. Right now, we tend to build them for investors and for our own account. But if Duke wants to buy the facilities we build, we'd be happy to sell them.
Steve, one of your jobs at the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State is to educate about sustainable energy and to provide support for these technologies. Is there still a lot for businesses and for individuals to know about solar power before they buy into it?
Well, absolutely. The market has changed so dramatically and so quickly, particularly in the last 3 years. Those price drops that John was talking about, you know, really have occurred very recently in the last 2 or 3 years. And so there's a lot of misperception about the cost of solar still in the marketplace. And so that's one major issue that we spend a lot of time educating on. Another is that, you know, the technology is relatively new to the marketplace. And so while consumers may be very interested in it, consumers also have to go through things like the local permitting process. They have to get an electrical inspection if they're going to do it at their home or at their business. And a lot of times the code officials in the various counties around the state have never even seen a system. And so we've been spending a lot of time lately educating those kinds of folks on these technologies to get them up to speed. Another group that we've been spending a lot of time with are economic developers. You know, a lot of the projects that John and companies like his are building in the state are in rural areas of the state where there hasn't been a lot of significant investment for many years of any kind. And these solar projects are going in, and they're creating real economic value in those counties and doing it without the need for the county to invest in a whole lot of new supporting infrastructure, like a school if you were building a housing development.
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned yesterday. It never even occurred to me, John. You most of your solar farms are in rural areas, and because you need a lot of land for these farms, and you say that you're increasing the tax base in what have been traditionally low-wealth counties.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the past 2.5 years, Strata has attracted close to $1 billion. That's with a B. Of investment to North Carolina in solar energy. Almost half of that is in what we call our Tier 1 counties across the state. Those are the lowest wealth counties in the state. Mm-hmm. 85% of it are in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties that we have. So the vast majority of this investment is going to the parts of our state that have historically been bypassed in terms of economic opportunity.
John Morrison,
Steve pointed out, that's tax base for those local counties that have long struggled.
Let me stop you there. John Morrison is Senior VP for Strata Solar. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Cincinnati Insurance Companies, offering business, home, auto, and life insurance through a network of independent agents supported by local claims service. Information at CINFIN.com. Not all coverage is available in all markets. Well, as we've come to learn, there is an immense amount of big data floating around out there about everything, mostly about us. Now, it's called big data, and because it's so enormous. The stash of information is so enormous. And making sense of it all, well, that's become increasingly difficult. And those who know how to make sense of it are in increasing demand, which is why area colleges and universities are teaching the next generation of people to understand how to analyze this data. Now, it can be put to bad use, but it can also be put to good use. And we'll take a look at one of those potential good uses in the healthcare industry, among other things, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, it's harder than ever to find affordable housing in the U.S. The role of government, private developers, and banks in today's housing market.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about solar power, how well it's doing in North Carolina, why it's doing so well. And in a moment, excuse me, we're going to talk about what are some perceived threats to that success with Steve Calland, who is Executive Director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State University. He joins us by phone. John Morrison is in a studio in Chapel Hill. He is the Senior Vice President for Asset Management and Government Affairs for Strata Solar. And Randy Willis is the Renewable Spokesperson for Duke Energy. They are here in our, he is here in our studio. And one of the reasons you buy a lot of the solar-powered energy from companies like Strata is because of energy policy in the state.
Right. In 2007, there was energy policy passed in the state that mandated that Duke Energy, by the year 2021, will have 12.5% of its retail sales either from energy efficiency or renewable energy. So we've been busy the last few years, and it kind of stair-steps up to the 12.5% figure. But we've been very active since then, buying renewables where we can. And luckily, the solar cost coming down has really helped us. It's helped a lot of solar being built in this state, which we're buying. We're buying most of the solar in this state.
Perhaps that mandate, that legal mandate, that 12.5% come from renewable sources, I'm sure it's not in response to this, but it could be. Slate.com says that North Carolina is an environmental nightmare, except when it comes to solar. And they went on to call us the other sunshine state. Bring on Anita Bryant, because of the growth of solar in the state. And your company, John, builds solar farms, of which you will have built 50 by the end of this year. This is a well-kept secret. I had no idea. And you have about $1 billion, as you said a moment ago, in solar investments in the state. How large are these farms, and how much power do they generate?
Well, the typical farm we build has an output capacity of 5 megawatts when it's operating at its peak.
And what does that mean? What is 5 megawatts?
Five megawatts, it's a measure of capacity in terms of the amount of energy we produce. We produce, in the course of a year, the energy equivalent of that consumed by about 600 to 700 homes on one of these typical farms. So, they're about 40 acres in size.
So when you say you generate 5 megawatts, is that 5 megawatts a year, 5 megawatts a day?
That's the capacity. That's the maximum amount the farm can produce. Now, it depends on how much sun is shining on the farm as to what its actual production is.
And if you're up at full capacity, what could that 5 megawatts power? A neighborhood? Is that what you just said?
Well, the electricity is going to go onto the grid, and so it's going to power whatever's nearby. The electrons are going to follow the laws of physics and go to the closest load. But in terms of the amount of energy that's produced, so over the course of time, be it a day or a year, as I said earlier, in the course of a year, it will produce enough energy to offset the energy use of 600 to 700 homes.
Wow. Slate.com also says that last year, North Carolina added 335 megawatts of capacity to their solar generating abilities. That's the third best of any state in the country, with a total of 592 megawatts of solar capacity installed. 592 megawatts. Put that into some sort of framework for me.
If you look at the McGuire Nuclear Station, a very large nuclear station north of Charlotte, that's about 2,000 megawatts, a little over 2,000 megawatts. So what is that, a quarter of a nuclear plant? So, I mean, 500 megawatts is a good amount.
So when we talk about producing this power, which is free I mean, it's from the sun. There's no coal being burned. There's no nuclear.
Yeah, the fuel cost is free. Yeah.
The fuel. Well, isn't that most of it? And when you talk about the infrastructure of having to build a nuclear power plant or a dam on a river or build a coal-fired plant, isn't it much cheaper to build these solar farms?
The capital costs have come down, but still, if you look at what would be the least cost way to meet load, I think natural gas would still be in the lead.
Really?
Yeah.
Even though you have to build.
Gas is pretty inexpensive, although in parts of the country where electricity is higher, it has gotten to be a very close horse race. I think that, you know, if you had to look at building a new nuclear plant or a new coal plant these days, I think solar would probably actually win that conversation. Mm.
Stratus Solar has built their farms in Tennessee, Missouri, California, Georgia, Virginia, and Massachusetts, and obviously North Carolina as well. Is Massachusetts a good place for solar power?
We have some solar there as well in Massachusetts. It has some attractive energy policy.
The solar resource in Massachusetts obviously isn't nearly as great, but the state policies make it financially doable.
This is why you have to study math, isn't it?
and finance.
Math and finance is a big piece of it, that's for sure. Yeah. You know, the world's leading solar market is actually Germany, which has roughly the same solar resource as Alaska. So, you know, this is the energy world. You know, everything in energy is subsidized out the wazoo, so to speak. And so, you know, just looking at what's going on in energy, policy matters no matter what technology you're talking about.
Well, people don't realize that. I want you to say that again, that all energy, including the gasoline you put in your car, is subsidized. And people don't know that, and they get upset because we're giving subsidies to try to develop solar technology. The president got himself into trouble because he put money into a solar company that went belly up. And people say, you see, we're just throwing money down a rat hole. But we do it for all these energy companies, right?
No, that's absolutely true. There's subsidies embedded in the system from, you know, production of coal and extraction of oil all the way up to the use of those energy supplies.
Why do we do that for energy sources that have been used for 100 years?
That's a very good question.
In some cases, that's the way we've always done it.
John?
Yeah, and it has to do with the political clout of established industries. I mean, that's part of the challenge that solar faces is that its costs are coming down, and it has a lot of public support. But what it doesn't have, because it's a relatively young industry, is the political clout that the oil and gas industry and others maintain in this country.
Randy?
Yeah, I think the president is advocating an all-of-the-above energy policy, which includes coal, natural gas, nuclear, includes all those things. So, because I think we need that. I think we have to have a diverse energy mix, because I think if we bet on any one source too much, it'll come back to bite us.
Well, as we've heard in this conversation, at the industrial scale, Massachusetts is a favorable place for solar farms to be placed, not because of the amount of sunshine, but because of state policy, which means tax incentives and other goodies and things like that. But I understand.
Well, it also means consumer acceptance. Try siting a power plant in Massachusetts these days. You know, consumers would have a coronary. It's just very hard because of what they call NIMBY, not in my backyard, to site power plants, whereas solar tends to be a lot more consumer friendly.
All right. But at the local level, at the homeowner level, people who do install these are helped greatly by tax incentives. I'm told that the cost can be offset almost by 50%.
Right.
But some of those tax incentives are scheduled to sunset in 2015. Well, why would we sunset a tax incentive for a new and rapidly developing technology that seems to be working? Why would we do that when we still have it for oil, gas, and coal?
Well, I think the tax credits in North Carolina, there's a 30% federal tax credit, and then there's a 35% state tax credit. So, you know, more than half of the facilities being picked up by the taxpayers. You know, we don't set tax policy at Duke Energy, but, you know, when they were established, they had a sunset date, you know, and right now that will expire unless it's continued on. I mean, you could argue that there's a lot of other places that taxpayer money should go. People can make their own arguments, highways, hospitals, education. So, you know, it's a game. It's a situation that will be decided by the legislature of whether those tax credits expire or continue.
Steve and John,
gets back to that policy discussion. You know, that one of the big differences between the subsidies for renewables and the subsidies for some of the more established technologies is the nature of those subsidies. You know, for example, the subsidies in the fossil industry are embedded much further down the supply chain, and they're much less visible, and in many cases don't have the same types of expiration dates on them, so they don't have to have these fights on a regular basis. I always think about things like the Price-Anderson Act, which is a federal law that in essence provides a lot of the insurance risk, takes a lot of the insurance risk on operating and owning nuclear power plants out of the mix for electric utilities. If it wasn't for that act, it would be almost impossible to own and operate a nuclear power plant just because of the insurance costs. Things like that are major subsidies to the industry, but they don't get talked about in the same context as tax credits for solar.
The growth in solar power in this state, and I guess around the country, is coming at the same time that we have reached a stage of unexpected energy independence. We've found new sources of oil through fracking. But fracking comes at a time of climate change, and we're worried about what fossil fuels are doing to the atmosphere. We're also worried about what coal power is doing to the atmosphere in terms of what it – although we've gotten very good with scrubbers and smokestacks, but there's coal ash, and we had a problem in this state with coal ash, which is a byproduct of it. Can continued growth in solar offset the need for coal-produced power or for fracking in any meaningful way? Or should we just consider this another part of the mix of producing electricity?
I think it's part of the mix. It's a good complement, but I think you're still going to need those diverse other energy sources.
John?
I would add to that. We have to have diversity in our energy sources. As in any case, if you're investing financially, you know, what's the advice? Diversify. You don't want to be dependent on any one technology. And I think it's important to note that even though solar is growing very, very rapidly, it starts from a very small base. And so as a fraction of the overall generation portfolio here in North Carolina, we're still less than 1%. And so it's growing. We're number three, number four in the nation, but it's still a tiny, tiny amount of our overall energy generation portfolio.
Yeah. And John makes a good point. It is still a small part. But I think if you looked at Duke Energy's integrated resource plan going forward for the next 15 years, the percentage of growth is going to be very high for renewables. But still, it's only had a couple years head start where coal, nuclear, and others have had, you know, almost 100 years there.
So we're halfway through the hour, and this has been a very amicable conversation. And yet there is some tension, not in this room, but within the industry, because Duke Energy has been blamed for pushing changes that many feel could blot out the solar industry here, or certainly considerably slow it down. And let me see if I understand this. The solar power generated by these private companies, such as John Morrison's Strata Solar, on privately owned farms is converted from the direct current that solar arrays produce into alternating current, which is then sent to the power grid, which is how we get electricity. And according to a federal law passed in the 1970s, power companies, in this case Duke Energy, have to buy that power. You must buy it. Any power generation project under 5 megawatts, which is about enough power to run 500 or 600 homes, as we've said, gets paid what it would cost the utility to provide that energy. Over 5 megawatts, and the utility can negotiate the price they pay for that energy. Am I getting all this right? So far?
Pretty good.
Okay.
That's good.
Both Duke Energy and Dominion Resources, which is the big power company in Virginia, which also generates some power for people living in North Carolina, they want the State Utilities Commission to set the threshold at 200 times lower to the federal minimum. What does that mean, Randy?
Well, maybe I'll try to keep this brief. What happened in July, the Utilities Commission, with so much solar going on, I think the Utilities Commission said, hey, should we look at the methodology and other metrics of how these contracts are negotiated, or is it just perfect, or should the terms be longer, be shorter? So 4 days of hearings in Raleigh, everyone had a say. And I think what the commission is looking for is fairness for customers, the utilities, and the developers. Duke would like more flexibility to negotiate contracts with developers because we think customers with very long-term contracts, customers might pay more than they should. But, you know, John's going to be on the other side, and he's making his case as well.
And, John, you spent, I guess it costs a lot of money to build these solar arrays. You either have to buy the land or rent the land, and you've got to pay for the equipment, and you've got to pay for the people who set it up. But once it's set up, it pretty much runs itself. Is there any cost to running it once it's up and running?
Well, certainly there's no fuel cost. The sunshine's free. We do have to maintain the site, at the very least mow the grass and and keep the fence intact.
And hose off the panels
and do
every
maintenance
once in a while.
On the mechanical equipment that's there. But it's the cost of it is in the capital, in the actual construction. They cost more to build, but less to operate. And that's true of all different generation technologies. Some of them are costly on the capital end and have a lower fuel cost. Some of them, such as a simple cycle gas turbine, are very cheap to build but have a very high fuel cost. And so it's important to understand that combination of the capital cost to build it and the fuel cost.
Is your revenue flow fairly predictable? I mean, you can't predict the weather, and it could be cloudy for a month. So therefore, you can't generate to capacity on a cloudy day, it seems to me. So can you predict your revenue, and are your margins fairly small so that if Duke Energy is allowed to pay less than they pay now, that would throw you into a serious situation?
Yes, the issue of the price that we're paid for our electricity is a very big issue, and that's why we make sure we're well represented at the Utilities Commission when those decisions get made. The price is set at what's called the utility's avoided cost. And that's by federal law, and the Utilities Commission makes sure that that's indeed the price that we're paid for the electricity. That essentially means that it costs the utility the same to generate their own electricity or buy it from us. The reason for that is that the ratepayer is financially indifferent as to whether the utility buys it or the utility generates it itself. The cost is the same, and in utility speak or regulatory speak, that's called avoided cost. And every 2 years, the commission sets that price, and they set it for those standard contracts, the ones you mentioned that are below 5 megawatts.
I'm glad John got to explain avoided cost.
I wish you would explain it again because I read it yesterday and I still don't understand it.
Yeah, it's a tough issue. But I'll back up a second. The reason the Utilities Commission is looking at this closely is that right now there are more than 420 solar farms in development in North Carolina, some stage. A lot of them may not be built. If you add all the megawatts that these projects are looking to build, it's around 3,300 megawatts, which is more than the Guire nuclear station and the Harris nuclear station put together. So there's a groundswell of new solar being built in the state, and I think the commission wanted to look and see, make sure they've got the rules right as we go forward.
And we'll talk about this in more broad strokes or fine strokes later on in the program, but the problem here, from your point of view at Duke Energy, is that you have to buy this power. Whether you need it or not, whether you want it or not, if they generate it, you have to buy it, correct?
Correct. And, you know, we have to buy it wherever it is. You know, the geography.
So if they blanket the state with, if every nook and cranny has a solar array and it's generating power, you have to buy it?
Yeah, if it's under 5 megawatts, we definitely have to buy it.
So now homeowners are certainly under 5 megawatts, and many homeowners have these arrays on their roof or are thinking about putting it up there. And much of what they generate goes to the grid because they generate more in normal cases than their house can use. So it gets flowed out to the grid, and you pay them for that power. Do you want to change the rate you're paying them?
It's a little different than that, though, with residential customers.
Okay.
Residential customers, when they install these systems, there may be some back and forth of electricity during the course of a day, a month, a week, a year, but usually most homeowner systems are netted out to look more like the load of the house. And so there's, on a net basis, very little excess generation. And in North Carolina, that excess generation is basically given to the utilities for free in a residential system under what's called net metering. So there's no actual payment by the utility for that net excess generation in a net metered system.
Let me stop you there because I've got to take a break. We'll come back and follow up on that in just a moment. That's Steve Calland with the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, offering accounting, tax, and financial advisory services for local businesses with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville, Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. It's harder than ever to find affordable housing in the U.S., and Diane Rehm and her guests will be talking about the role of government, private developers, and banks in today's housing market. Coming up in 20 minutes, 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Perhaps you'd like to talk about solar energy. Well, now's your chance. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. That will get you to us, and we are coming right back.
Stay connected to what's going on locally, nationally, and around the world. Get up to date on the latest news of the day by listening to All Things Considered, 4 till 6:30 p.m. on 90.7 WFAE. Join Mark Rumsey and the cast of journalists from NPR and WFAE to hear the most thorough and comprehensive news coverage that happened while you were at work. That's All Things Considered, 4 till 6:30, weekday afternoons on Charlotte's NPR news source, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about solar energy and tensions, I suppose, between the solar energy producers, some tension, and Duke Energy, because we're in the middle of negotiations with the State Utility Commission about how much Duke will pay or wants to pay for the power being produced by these entities. Steve Callen is with us, Executive Director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State University. John Morrison is Senior Vice President for Asset Management and Government Affairs at Strata Solar. They have solar farms all over the state. And Randy Wheelis is renewable spokesperson for Duke Energy. Prior to the break, Steve, you were talking about homeowners, but as I understood this, Duke, and I may be wrong, Duke wants to pay individual homeowners with solar arrays on their roofs what they pay the operators of these big farms. Now, no money exchanges hands, but what I understand you to do is if as a homeowner, I'm feeding power to the grid, you take the power that
we have taken from you,
and you give me a credit on my bill.
Right.
So you want to change what the credit may be. Are you giving me right now, if I have to pay X cents per kilowatt hour, and I'm giving you a kilowatt hour of power, am I getting that X cents back, or do you want to give me less than I'm paying?
Right now, it's a one-for-one trade. Yeah. Whenever you give us that power, we credit you,
and you
that power.
And you want to change that in some way?
Well, I think here's the one thing you can look at it this way. You know, Duke Energy is buying solar power from many sources,
right,
like Strata, and we're basically paying a wholesale rate. But yet on the homeowner side, when you give us a kilowatt of electricity, we're crediting you a retail rate.
Yes, so why shouldn't you?
Yeah, but why don't we buy it somewhere else? Why do we need to buy your power at all? But also, there's a bit of a cost shift going on here. As you buy less power from us, you're really not paying what you need for the infrastructure of the grid. So homeowners with rooftop are kind of sidestepping that issue a little bit and not paying for that. The grid, which they still need just to start their air conditioner. So there's a lot of discussion in that. A lot of states around the nation are tackling that issue.
Okay.
It's not in front of the commission right now, but it may be in the future.
Steve?
Yeah, and it is a subject where there is a good bit of debate around the country. There are a lot of studies that show that residential systems distributed across a network actually bring benefit to the utility grid that outweighs the cost. And so it will be something that will probably eventually have to go before a commission or some other body for them to figure out exactly how to have that calculation be done. But groups like the National Renewable Energy Lab, which is a part of the U.S. Department of Energy, have done studies and shown that, you know, the net benefits of net metered systems outweigh those costs, and that, you know, what happens is that utilities tend to focus on one side of the ledger in that conversation. You know, and it is kind of an interesting distinction to make between the kinds of systems that John builds and residential systems. It's important to understand that solar scale matters so much that when you get into a discussion about smaller scale systems that are connected to a load, so they're on a building and they're designed to help serve the load in that building, the economics and the mechanics of those systems are so different than what John does, where he builds a power plant, in essence, that's designed to feed the grid. That it's almost as different as talking about natural gas versus coal in terms of the impacts and the policy needs. And
well, let's go back and talk about then these solar farms, because this is what the principal negotiation or what the Utilities Commission is looking at right now, and they look at it every 2 years, and this is where the friction comes in here. You have to buy power by federal law from these solar farms that produce the power, whether you need it or not, and you want to be able to pay less for the power you get from these
It's not so much
farm.
Pay less, but it's just the right
negotiate.
More to negotiate, exactly.
Because right now you're paying a fee that is set no matter what.
Right, and
do
it's
you
under,
not,
under 5 megawatts, but the thing is we're paying it no matter where it is. I mean,
okay.
It would be nice if it was blanketing, but they can also be, you know,
do you need this power? Could you get along without it? Would you be happy with not getting this power?
Well, you have to go back to energy policy. We have a mandate to meet 12.5%.
That's not the question. The question is, does Duke Energy need or want this power?
I think it's useful power. It's built. Someone should use it. And our customers are asking for more renewable energy. And there it is. Let's go ahead and take advantage.
So you just want the ability to negotiate the price.
Right.
Okay.
And because I think really what a lot of solar developers would say, John will probably say this, is that 5 megawatts is kind of a small farm. They would like to build larger. And I think larger will bring more cost effective.
And if they build larger farms, the price is negotiable by federal
Correct.
Law. So let's bring John into this conversation, because right now, you know, everything is driven by policy. And everybody, including individuals, takes, if they're smart, take advantage of how the policy is written. So my question, John, is, are you building these farms, and I think you have 40 across the state, below the 5 megawatt or at the 5 megawatt generation capacity, just so you can get that guaranteed rate? Or would you really like to build larger farms where the rate is negotiated?
Well, certainly scale means lower costs. And if we could build larger farms, we could do that at even lower costs than what we're doing today. But even more important than scale is predictability. For a business such as ours, we need to be able to predict when we can build these solar farms. And so the standard contract that exists in North Carolina is a huge, huge help to the solar industry, because we know that we can identify a site, we can go through all the diligence and environmental issues and making sure that it's a suitable site for solar, and then go arrange the financing. We have to go to Wall Street, to the capital markets, to fund these projects. And we can do that knowing that we can say, here's exactly what our revenue stream is going to look like, because it's a standard contract. It's been approved by the Utilities Commission. And so that gives us a great deal of predictability. And so that enables us to build solar farms on a very, very regular basis. We've taken essentially what's a construction process, sort of a one-off sort of thing, and turned it into a manufacturing process. And so once a crew builds a farm, takes us about 11 weeks to build out 40 acres or so. Once a farm is constructed, we take that crew, move them onto the next farm.
So you're not,
so we can be very, very efficient with the use of our labor, with our materials, and everything else.
So you are literally moving. It takes you 7 days or so to build one of these farms, and then as soon as you're done, you're moving on to some other location. So every week you're adding capacity. Every week you're adding these solar farms online at the 5 megawatt rate, which Duke Power has to buy, and they have to buy it at a set rate. Now, you're not gaming the system, I don't think, but you're certainly using the system. As you said, you have to get financing to build these farms, and they want to know what the banks, the Wall Street investment people, want to know what the return on investment is going to be. This is one way you can tell them. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If we don't know what our revenue stream is going to be, we can't predict what sort of financial return, and there's no investor that's going to come into a farm under those circumstances.
Duke Energy would like for these farms to be bigger, because at the bigger scale, they can the law allows them to negotiate the price. But state numbers, Randy, show that of the more than 60 projects over the 5 megawatt limit at which you can start negotiating, only three of the 60 have reached a negotiated agreement. What does that say about the price that you're trying to get from these producers?
You know, I've seen that figure too. I think there's a lot of reasons why those projects didn't get to finality, and I don't think Duke Energy was the main reason there. One thing I probably should add in here is that right now, back in February, we issued a request for 300 megawatts of new solar capacity in North Carolina. This is new capacity. And we're coming to the final stages of that. And in that, we said that we wanted to have larger solar farms. So we're working hard. Hopefully next month we'll have some announcement.
But you want the larger solar farms because you want the capacity, or because you can pay a lower price? Because you have said you pay a lower price. The end user, the customer that turns the light switch on, will pay a lower price.
Right, because we need to meet our mandate. So we want larger projects to have the most cost effective. And larger farms will give us a more cost effective price, which we can pass on to customers.
If Duke Energy got their wish here, John Morrison, is that something that your company and other companies like your could do and still make money on and still find the financing to build these projects?
Well, I think the position that would be better off for the ratepayers of North Carolina would be actually to increase the standard contract, because we get with
increase,
the standard contract, we get
what,
the regularity,
the
and if we get
hold on,
increase the size Because it's only up to 5 megawatts at this point. So if we increase the size, we get the advantages of scale, and we maintain the advantages of predictability and regularity.
But Duke, as I understand it, wants to cut the length of the contracts. Because right now you have, what, 15-year contracts?
15 years.
And you want to cut it to 10 years. Do you make back your initial investment in 10 years, John, on these farms?
Well, it's I mean, the analogy there is like a homeowner. You know, I can buy a lot more house if I can finance it over 30 years as opposed to if I go out and get a 15-year mortgage.
Would it be more
and that's in essence the same thing here, is that our cost of financing is lower if we have a longer term. What you typically see in the energy industry is that when any firm, a utility or a private independent power producer, goes out to invest in a farm, raise capital, they typically would prefer to do it over the length of the life of the asset. And that's what you see the utilities doing on a regular basis. And that's certainly the argument that we would make, is that we think the term should be the length of the life of the asset, which in the case of a solar farm is 25-plus years.
So you'd like the contracts to be longer?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
we
so
could
now,
lower our costs even more if we had longer contracts.
So if the contract were to be cut to 10 years, if they didn't renew the contract at Duke Energy, what would happen to the power that you're generating or to the farm itself? Would you have to take it down? Would you have to turn it off? What would happen?
Well, the farm still remains a qualifying facility under the federal law. And so the Duke would continue to have to buy that power.
So what's the contract? So what's the contract for? The price?
Yes. And the term of it, I mean, we have to go to the financial communities and say, this is what our revenue stream is. And they say, we want to see a contract for that revenue stream.
Okay.
And so if the contract is only 10 years, they're going to operate from the assumption it goes to zero. Now, I think that's an inappropriate assumption,
right,
but I can't change the minds of big banks.
Well, would Duke Energy build a power plant, a coal-fired power plant, a natural gas power plant, a nuclear power plant, under those conditions, if they knew that in 10 years there was no contract to sell that power?
Well, you know, we have our own renewables operation working in 12 other states who are kind of doing that already. And a lot of times when we build power plants, they don't get put into rates until we finish them. So we pretty much have to carry a lot of cost of that plant until it is put into
but
rates.
But you're a lot bigger than most of these companies.
Well, and in many of those other states, the terms of those contracts look a lot more like what John is describing, with longer terms and higher rates.
Okay. Utilities have also argued that these long-term contracts lock people into rates that might be high when these contracts are signed, and they lock them in for 15 years. And so this would give them a chance to dollar cost average, because maybe after 10 years, power rates have gone down and they can renegotiate the contract and the price they pay, and therefore it'd be easier on everybody. But isn't it also true that if you signed a 15-year contract with somebody, you could be signing it when prices are low?
There's a possibility, but I think a lot of times the price is set on natural gas, and there's a trend line of natural gas and as it goes out. And we think the longer-term contract, like 20 years, puts the burden or puts the customer more at risk at overpaying than it does any benefit that they may underpay. I mean, but that's a disagreement. That's something the commission is weighing now, is how to, you know, what is the proper term of that? Is it 15 years? Is that still good? Or should it be shorter or longer? I think the commission is weighing that, and hopefully they'll have a decision in the fall.
So you'd like it to
As an energy user, I certainly would hope that energy prices go down. Unfortunately, I don't think that's in our future. We see a lot of retirements of plant capacity across the country and with Duke. And what we also see are new regulations, particularly around carbon, coming from the EPA, that, if anything, are going to push our energy prices up. And so I believe solar is a very good hedge against what I think is inevitable energy price increases going forward, and that when we get out, you know, 5 or more years from the construction of a farm, we're going to look at these farms and say, this is a great deal for the ratepayers, because look, I can get energy at a cost well below what the current rate will be.
What does it cost to
get out in the future?
What does it cost to build one of these 5 megawatt solar farms?
The investment is on the order of somewhere between $1.50 and $3 a watt. Depending on where you are in the country.
Don't make me do the math.
Yeah, well, so I mean, for the 40-acre, 5-megawatt solar farms that Strata builds, we're talking somewhere in the $10 to $20 million a farm range.
And what does it cost to build a coal-fired plant?
You know, it can be $1 billion.
$1 billion.
But you have also a plant that runs all the time.
Okay,
as
so
well.
If you're cutting, if you're complaining about signing a 15-year contract at X amount of dollars, why not just cut out the middleman and build your own plants?
Well, I think you may see that soon in the future. But, you know, one thing I want to add on to what John said about the price of electricity, I mean, one thing North Carolina has to brag about, we have a lot of solar, fourth in the nation, but our rates are about 20% below the national average. So if you look at states that have a lot of solar, usually their rates are going to be higher, California, Massachusetts, New Jersey. So we've done a good job. I think we all should take credit here. Of adding as much solar as we have in this state, but still our rates are below the national average and are still very attractive.
In fairness.
And I think we need to be careful that we make sure we're clear on the cause and effect of that particular relationship. The states in which we see lots of solar are states which have historically had very high energy rates. And when you have high energy rates, alternative sources of generation then make much, much more sense. And so the reason you have a lot of solar in those states is because the prices already were very high. I don't believe solar is driving those prices up.
No, I don't think solar is not. But, you know, there are a lot of states that have high electric rates and don't have the solar we have in North Carolina. So I think we have something to be proud of.
And as I understand it, Duke Energy, if they wanted to build their own solar arrays, cannot take advantage of some of the tax credit that private companies can take advantage of when they build the solar arrays. So will it cost you more to build them?
We have to normalize it over a period of the life of the asset. So, but there may be other advantages we have when we want to build facilities. And of course, like I said, we have solar and wind in 12 states.
When does this go, Steve? When will the State Utilities Commission make a decision on that?
Oh, boy, I hope soon.
It's going to be this fall.
Within our lifetime.
That's harder than trying to predict seasons or something, or weather or something.
But certainly this fall. Steve Calland is Executive Director of NC Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State University. John Morrison, Senior Vice President of Asset Management and Government Affairs at Strata Solar. And Randy Willis, Renewable Spokesperson for Duke Energy. Thank you all for the hour.